I'm in a quantum state, so I can be present at two places at a time, I guess. So that's right, I've been observed. So I'm in trouble, actually, because I hadn't read the instructions properly. I hadn't realized that it's actually 30 minutes talk with 15 minutes discussions. I have way too many slides. I have to zip through them. But anyway, so this is the title. And the aim of the talk is come up with a new ways of trying to discriminate different specific the theories once we find something interesting at the OHC and also other collider experiments. And motivation, I zip through this, is very clear. We're entering a new era, and just go briefly through the history. Around 1900, we reached atomic scale. In 1970, we reached the strong interaction scale. Now we are reaching the weak scale. And this is actually a dream scale we have been talking about all the way since Fermi. And the interesting thing by looking at this list is that these scales turned out to be not fundamental. They are all derived scales out of more fundamental constants. So that's likely the case with the weak scale as well. The weak scale probably turns out to be also a derived scale out of some more fundamental theories. If that is the case, we do expect some rich physics to be present at the TeV energy scale. And of course, we get started with the Higgs bosons. And I'm going to skip this slide on Higgs. Then just remind everybody who, of course, everybody is familiar with this point already, that many of the new physics models actually kind of look alike. Supersymmetry gives you missing ET multiple jets, especially B jets or like sign or opposite sign leptons. Universal extra dimension does the same. Even Technicolor would do the similar things. And the, one of the major discriminators among these possibilities are the spins of the particles. And we actually have no idea, absolutely no idea, what we're going to find at TeV energy scale. If you try to draw the map of all theoretical possibilities, that's going to look like this. And there are many things nobody have thought of yet, and then many of the talks at this conference will be devoted to find yet another island somewhere out there. And of course, we have to focus down on a single point after we see the data, and that will be a very major task to do. And I'm going to zip through this slide too. So once we find something interesting, of course, we have to attain the absolute confidence that we know what we have found. And if you take an example of supersymmetry, it's easy to reach what I call the New York Times level confidence that you might see headline like this one. But there's still a long way to go from this level of confidence to what I call the Halliday-Resnick level of confidence, where you can put some statement like this one in the freshman physics textbook. And to get there, what we have to do is something really mundane and actually the basic things. We have to do spectroscopy, do kinematic fits, precision mass branching fraction measurements. And at the end of the day, the very important thing is spin parity measurement. This is a mock-up of PDG 2012. Now it has a listing of squawks, has J equals zero question mark. And the header even says that alternative interpretation as extra dimensional particles is possible. See KK particle listing. So there will be a lot of ambiguity once we see the data. So how do we get started with these really basic measurements like measuring spin of new particles? And there are many conventional methods, of course, proposed already. Some techniques are really designed to distinguish models. So you make a hypothesis that this new physics we have seen at the LHC is based on certain model and try to see the consistency based on that model assumption. And for example, comparing cross-section falls into that kind of category. And at the linear collider, you can also do threshold scans, which gives you more model-independent information, but you still cannot distinguish, for example, higher spins between the vector bosons and fermions. So you still have a long way to go. Even though ILC is being discussed as sort of an ultimate dream machine, it still may leave, for example, ambiguity if you don't want to rely on models and just try to do model-independent extraction of spin information. Then the only thing you can rely on are the shapes, and then the UED and supersymmetry might have very similar shapes in distribution. So that would give you a hard time trying to figure out what's going on. And this is a similar thing about the decay distributions, and I'm going to skip this. And I'm going to skip this one too. So what I would like to talk about is how exactly could we gain information about spin of new particles without making any model assumptions. So that's the purpose of the discussion here. So model-independent information on spin. So if you don't want to make any assumptions of the underlying models, the only thing you can rely on is quantum mechanics. And what we know from quantum mechanics is that angular momentum operators generate rotations. You put angular momentum operator on the exponent and with some vector attached to it, that generates rotation. And if you take the axis of rotation to be along the direction of the momentum, then the orbital angular momentum piece drops out because that's always orthogonal to the momentum vector, so the spin can be isolated. So what you can do then is to take this unitary operator, take the axis of the rotation to be along the momentum axis, then that will single out information on the spin. So, and that's nothing but the helicity of the particle. So decay, once you have a particle with definite helicity, namely that the projection of the angular momentum along the momentum axis is h, and suppose it decays, then you define this plane of decay products. So that's a decay plane. And what this the unitary operator does is to generate rotation of this decay plane. And that rotation, of course, picks up a phase according to the unitary operator. Now that this JZ has an angular, eigenvalue H, so that gives you a phase factor of e to the I H phi when you rotate this plane by an angle phi. So that's the azimuthal angle phi, and rotation of this plane would give you this phase factor. But of course, phase factor by itself doesn't give you any interesting information, because once you take the absolute square of the amplitude to get the cross section, that gives you just one, so there's no dependence on this azimuth. So that tells you that once you have something rotationally invariant decaying, of course, there's no dependence on the azimuthal angle in the decay distributions, and this is not interesting at all. So somehow we need to recover information on this angle phi. But it turns out nature is actually kind to us, because when you produce some new particles, they are not necessarily produced in a single helicity state. They are typically produced in a linear superposition of many helicity eigenstates. So when you produce a new particle that comes in a linear superposition of various helicity eigenstates, so when they decay into a specific final state, they all interfere. So you actually pick up information on these phase factors for different values of H, which interfere among each other, so that you actually end up with interesting phi dependence in the end. So the basic idea is just this. So when you have try to calculate a cross section of producing some new particles which decay down to standard model particles or whatever, you have this production amplitude multiplied with decay amplitude. And here I'm relying on the narrow width approximation so that I can break up the amplitude into production piece and decay piece. And then what I have just told you on the previous slide is this. The decay amplitude depends on the orientation of this decay plane, depending on this angle phi. And that can be written in terms of the same decay amplitude at zero azimuth together with this phase factor. But once you have this phase factor, you also sum over various helicity states of the particle you have produced. So when you actually take the absolute square in the end, then you find the cross terms among different the decay amplitudes for different helicities, that you pick up the differences in this phase factor e to the ih phi. So different helicities interfere once they decay. And phi dependence cross section then tells us what helicity states contribute to that the final state. And therefore, we can measure the helicity differences. So in a sense, this is like a neutrino oscillation. You can measure the phase differences because we're relying on quantum interferometer method. You can't determine the absolute value of the phase. But nonetheless, once you can measure the differences in phases, then that will give you a very important piece of information, namely that what is the biggest difference in helicity that contributed to that particular final state. So now getting into more details, I have to define what I mean by this angle phi, and it's just this. You have some collision, so this is the beam axis. When you produce some new particles, say two-to-two-body process, then this defines the production plane. And the new particle comes in this way and decays into other particles, let's say in two-body final state. So that defines this decay plane, spanned by the decay products here. And then you can define the relative angle between this decay plane and the production plane, and that's the azimuth phi I'm talking about. So when you do the rotation of this decay plane around the axis of the momentum of the particle, that picks up the phase, as I said, e to the I h times phi, and when the particle comes in multiple helicity states, they all interfere in the end. So just to give you a better idea on what's going on here, so if you produce a vector boson, spin 1, then you have three different helicity states, plus 1, 0, and minus 1. Each of them come with these different phase factors when you rotate the decay plane, e to the I phi, or 1, which corresponds to zero velocity, or e to the minus I phi. And when you add them up and then take the cross the cross terms among them, or when you take absolute square to get the cross section, then you pick up the helicity differences. So the final result ends up looking like this. So you have something that doesn't have phi dependence. You have something that goes like cosine of phi when you pick up the difference by one unit of helicity difference, or cosine 2 phi when you pick up the maximum difference in helicities between plus 1 and minus 1. If you have the spin 1/2 particle, then you have e to the I phi over 2, or e to the minus I phi over 2 for the helicities plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. So the series truncates earlier with cosine phi and no cosine 2 phi piece. So in general, when you have a high particle with spin, then the phi dependence of the cross section can be always written in this form. And highest term here is of great interest, because once you identify this cos n phi dependence on the azimuth phi, then n turns out to be twice the spin of the particle. So that way, you can gain model-independent information on the spin. And this is something I have looked at actually quite a while ago. In the case of E plus E minus going to Wiener pairs, decaying to lepton and thus neutrino final state, and it looks kind of messy. But the only important point here is that for Wiener 1 decay, you indeed have these e to the plus I phi over 2 or e to the minus I phi over 2 dependencies. And also for the Wiener 2 decay, you have the same thing for the azimuthal angle phi 2. And then you can look for the interferences among them. So that's the general principle, and it's very simple. So now we look at some real-life examples. And the first thing, of course, we had to do was to see if anybody had studied this effect, because it sounds so general and simple and easy. And of course, we looked for some papers to discuss that, and we couldn't find anything. And one of the best ways to find papers that discuss a particular topic these days is just to put out the paper no matter what and see if anybody complains in a couple of days. And nobody did. So that's a great good evidence that nobody has really looked at this. So we didn't find any the papers in the modern collider physics literature on this point. And indeed, most Monte Carlo programs actually don't have this effect built in. And many Monte Carlo programs actually produce particles in two-to-two-body process, and then let the new particles decay incoherently, typically according to phase space. And some of the improvements, of course, started taking care of the spin correlations and so on, but still many of them miss the quantum interference effects in the decay of the new particles. So this is actually one important issue, that if you try to study some explicit examples, you really have to make sure that your Monte Carlo program does include the quantum interference effects properly. So in our case, we actually wrote them from scratch using Keller's. But in any case, so most Monte Carlo programs don't have them, so not many studies have been made using this quantum interference effects among the helicity states. But of course, I had this vague suspicion that people in the 60s must have known this when people studied hadronic resonances and so on. But anyway, so one thing we would like to discuss first is to talk about examples that should already exist on tape from the current and the previous collider experiments, which should have this effect already in the data, so that we can try to dig it out and see if this method works at all. And actually, I have given the similar talk back home in Berkeley, and lo and behold, Dave Jackson was sitting in the audience. He raised his hand and said, "What about my paper written back in 1964?" And indeed, there was this paper by Dave Jackson and Kurt Gottfried, which talked about this interference effects among different helicity states. They referred to this as helicity density matrix. Of course, you can use density matrix formalism to discuss that effect. They don't quite do what I'm trying to do here, but nonetheless, of course, these effects have been known. And that's not really the point here. The point here is try to use this effect in a modern collider setting and try to use it as a way of determining spin of whatever new particles we might produce. So talking about LEP2, so we have studied E plus E minus going to W pairs. And of course, we know W boson has spin 1. But suppose you pretend that you don't know it and try to use this method and see if you can reconstruct the fact that W boson has spin 1. And if you study this phi dependence using the semi-leptonic final state, one of the W's go to lepton and neutrino, the other W goes to jet-jet, you can fully reconstruct the final state even though you're missing neutrino because of the beam energy constraint, and then you know how to define this decay plane relative to the production plane. And the phi dependence looks like this. This is phi from 0 to 2 pi, and this is the dependence. And you see prominent cos phi behavior, but the fact that top is flat shows there's actually negatively interfering cos 2 phi piece. So this distribution has both cos phi and cos 2 phi dependences in it. And if you fit this curve, then you can extract the coefficients for cos phi and cos 2 phi relative to the overall normalization, and these effects are actually quite big. The cos phi piece is negative 26% effect, and cos 2 phi piece is negative 8.6% effect. And this should definitely be visible once you analyze the data in this particular fashion. We also look at some examples of Tevatron, because one of the major aims here is try to apply this method eventually to the LHC, so we wanted to look at some Hadron Collider example. And we took something very simple, PP bar going to Z boson and a gluon, so Z boson recoiling against the jet, and Z decays into leptonic final state. Again, just by calculating this phi dependence, it is supposed to look like, I'm sorry, this doesn't come out very well in this rather bright light, but let me trace the curve here. It goes like this. So in this case, you see very prominent cos 2 phi dependence, but the fact that this peak here is lower than peak there shows there's also interfering cos phi piece. And again, by fitting this distribution here, you can extract the coefficients. The cos phi piece in this case is 6%. Cos 2 phi piece is 12%. So again, both dependencies are quite prominent once you have enough statistics. And you can also study other distributions, but this is just meant to say that the other distribution don't tell you exactly what the spin of the new particles are unless you make some further assumptions on the underlying models. So what I have been trying to describe using the helicity differences is totally model independent because it relies only on quantum mechanics. But if you look at other distributions, you have to put more information into the calculations, and therefore they are not completely model independent. So now that we have seen that this phi dependence can be prominent, getting to some practical issues like acceptance cuts. And actual experimental data always suffer from acceptance cuts because of the geometry of the detector. You can't always look at events in a forward direction. You also need to provide some additional cuts to avoid the problem with the backgrounds. And the issue here is the following. The whole discussion relied on the fact that you can do a rotation of the decay plane. And if your acceptance cuts is not invariant under the rotation of the decay plane, then your efficiency actually depends on this relative angle between the decay plane and production plane, and that ends up distorting the distribution you want to look at. And you will see how much the distribution gets distorted. So by looking at this LEP2 and the Tevatron data, we just grabbed cuts used in the experimental papers. And then we try to see if you can extract these the coefficients for cos phi and cos 2 phi modes. Just a reminder on how this the relative angle is defined. And in the case of cos phi, you also have to take a particular convention from which of the beams you were defining the angle phi. And cos odd phi factors are odd under the interchange of two beams, so you just need to pick a particular convention. And by simulating data with without any additional cuts, you can see this beautiful the dependence on phi I have shown based on just the theoretical calculation before. And once you have preserved this rotational invariant, you should be able to extract these the phi dependencies and therefore information on spin. But once you apply realistic cuts, as they had been used in the real experimental analysis, they get really distorted to something like this. And that's because you have to actually come up with a cut which depend on detector geometry, which is not invariant under the relative rotation of the production plane and decay plane. So somehow we have to recover the original information. Yeah. So this is why. So this is again an example of E plus minus going to W pairs, and W decays into lepton and neutrino. And you don't want to keep events, for example, where missing energy is going down the beam pipe. Then you're not properly capturing an event. Or you don't want to keep events where lepton is going down the beam pipe either. So this is the dead cone, so to speak. And if you do the rotation of this decay plane relative to the production plane, depending on how much rotation you do, you may get into the dead zone or you may come out of it. So there is the phi dependence on the efficiency, and which is the reason why there is this big distortion in the distribution. Matt? David?
I still didn't understand why. Could you go back to the previous slide?
Yes.
Why are you getting that? No, the one after. Why? I mean, I can see there's an effect, but why does it always sit at this phi equal to pi? Have you defined phi here?
I define phi like this.
Right.
So this is the production plane, and this is the decay plane, and this definition here basically says I define the normal vector of the decay plane. I define a normal vector of the production plane. This is just the inner product between two normal vectors, which is defined to be cos phi.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you choose events that are more central, then you get away from the dead cone, that should improve the situation.
You might, yeah. So it depends on really details. What is the cuts on rapidities, and what is the cuts on when the particle decays, you can't place cuts necessarily on the rapidity of the particle that has decayed, but typically you place cuts on the decay products. And that's why you have distortion of the phi distribution when you rotate this plane relative to the production plane. Does that answer your question?
It seems that it specifically requires that you put the cuts on
that's
the
right,
decay
right. But that's what typically experiments do. But as you have already suspected, I'm sure, there is a way to get around this. And I actually had an accident with my finger when I was cooking. I actually scraped off a piece of skin here. And I didn't think it was a big deal at the beginning, but I ended up having a skin graft. So that was a 2 hours operation. They took some piece of skin from here and put it on here, and I had to sit like this for 2 hours. And so that was actually a great moment to come up with new physics ideas. So this is what I did. So what I had to then come up with is to turn these cuts using experiments into something rotation invariant. And the idea is very simple. So going back to this plot, so what I can do then is to demand an experimental cut by observing an event with lepton and neutrino here, and then say, if I make an arbitrary rotation of the decay plane, I require that no particular angle would be eliminated by the cuts I employed. And then by definition, my cuts are invariant under rotation of the decay plane relative to the production plane. Of course, you get a hidden efficiency, but it turns out this is something you can probably live with, at least in the examples we have looked at, and then you recover this beautiful phi dependence as we had before. It's slightly different coefficients now because of the cuts, of course, give you a slightly different relative size between different amplitudes. But nonetheless, you can recover a non-zero the coefficients for cos phi and cos 2 phi. And of course, statistics is worse because of the hit inefficiency. But nonetheless, it's something you can try to do. And examples I'm showing here have not modified the cuts at all, so that the efficiency really gets you, and to make the significance of these the higher mode coefficients rather small. But there are certain things you can do about this. And for example, in the case of LEP2, we originally used exactly the same cuts Opal used. But when I talk to experimentalists, it's clearly the overkill cuts they have employed, because they didn't have any particular motivation to increase the efficiency further. They already had an efficiency with their non-rotational invariant cuts, which was as high as 90%, so they didn't have to work harder to make the efficiency better. But once you try to employ these rotational invariant cuts, you have to work harder to maximize the efficiency in the end, and it's something you can try based on mock data. And if you do that, and further combine four experiments, even with this kind of demand on the rotational invariance, you can still extract the coefficient of cos 2 phi at something like 3 sigma level. Well, delta R cut, we also promote this the rotational invariant way. So again, by making arbitrary rotation of the decay plane relative to production plane, we demand that it never falls into the value of delta r smaller than something. So we keep using this. And I'm sure this is actually probably the dumbest thing you can do, right? If you're a good experimentalist, you can probably come up with a better ways of making sure that your set of cuts would maintain some level of rotational invariance, or you may destroy it, but you can compensate that by the Monte Carlo studies. So there are better things you can do. And what we are doing here is probably the dumbest thing you can do, but nonetheless, this is the least model-dependent thing you can do. And so the way you extract the coefficients of cos phi and cos 2 phi don't rely on any models at all, as long as you can fully reconstruct the final state. And that way, you can extract information about the spin. So, lessons. We can extract interesting spin information from the existing data, so this method should work. And Beate Heinemann, whom we collaborated with in a case of the Tevatron Z recording against JET, she has already started looking into Tevatron data. So hopefully she can tell us eventually that this method actually works in real data. And once she's convinced and the community is convinced that this could work, then that gets applied to the LHC in the future. And an interesting comment, which I didn't discuss quantitatively, but that's something we know, is that this effect is particularly strong near threshold. And that's a good news for the Hadron colliders, where typically new particle productions are dominated quite close to the threshold. If you go far above the threshold, it turns out that most processes prefer particular helicity eigenstates, so that you start losing the interference effect. Even though that effect is not that prominent, because interference effect doesn't go like the size of the data set, but like a square root of them. So even if you have some other interfering amplitude smaller than a dominant piece, it doesn't go down as quickly as they might otherwise. But nonetheless, the effect is particularly strong near the threshold region, and that's where the data will be dominant anyway, so that's the good news. And seeing cos n phi dependence tells you completely model independently that the particle you have observed has spin n over 2 or greater. And the reason why I put inequality here is that you may end up in rather unfortunate situation that some of the interfering amplitudes are just small or missing. So you can't say that spin is less than something using this method. So if you don't see a particular cos n phi mode, it could be just that coefficient could not be small, or it's not there because spin is smaller, and you can't tell them apart. But on the other hand, if you do see if you do see significant cos n phi dependence, you can say completely model independently that spin is n over 2 or greater. And that's a very useful piece of information. And this works extremely well if the final states are fully reconstructible. The challenges that may come up in the realistic data is when the events are only partially reconstructible. And as we all know, many solutions to the hierarchy problem contain a weakly coupled stable massive particle, like neutralino in SUSY, B1 in UED. So that would make many of the events only partially reconstructible, and that would make the study somewhat more difficult. And in the case of a plus and minus going to, for example, Slepton or the Kaluza-Klein muon decaying to two muons and the missing, then you can use a beam constraint and try to fully to reconstruct the data. It turns out you have the same number of variables, the same number of observables, so you can actually solve the equations fully, but that turns out to be a quadratic equation. So you have two solutions for each event, and one of them is right, one of them is wrong, but there's no way to tell them apart on event-by-event basis. So this is this has the twofold ambiguity. Let's say you are looking at E plus E minus going to the scalar muons, and they are scalars, so it shouldn't have any interesting phi dependence. And if you have only two solutions, indeed, there's no phi dependence. But if you put also the fourth solution on top of it, you start developing the cos 2 phi looking dependence. And that's bad. But it turns out this is there when you're looking at the relative angle between one decay plane and the production plane. But you have two particles decaying. It turns out if you take the difference between two azimuths, then that doesn't depend on if you're looking at true solution or false solution. And this is just a graphical way of seeing this, but I have to zip through this. So if you define the event with all the quantities you can measure, you find a quadratic equation. That's where you have two solutions. And then two solutions are characterized by intersection of these two circles. So here's one solution, true solution, but there's the wrong solution as well. But it turns out if you take this delta phi instead of phi itself, that's the same value for both true solution and false solution. So you are now back into business. So you can study that. And so we actually looked at this. And so we try to differentiate the scalar muon, which doesn't have any phi dependence, versus Kaluza-Klein muon, which is supposed to have cos phi dependence. And this is the way it looks like. This is flat for scalar. This is the cos phi for spin 1/2. And again, putting cuts, it doesn't distort this distribution very much. Once you take delta phi, it seems to be much more immune to acceptance cuts as well. And at the end of the day, this is the fit result. And the size of the coefficients, A1, A2, A3, A4, as a function of the model parameters here. And in the case of spinner, the Kaluza-Klein muon, this is the level of signal you'll find on the coefficient of A1. And the difference between dashed line and solid line is if you have cuts or no cuts, and you see, again, the impact of cuts is minimal, so you can clearly differentiate spin 0 case and spin 1/2 case, unless model parameter turns out to be something really unfortunate. And you can try to do the same thing for higher spin, like Kaluza-Klein W boson, and see if there's a cos 2 phi mode. You do find the non-zero cos 2 phi coefficient. It turns out in this particular example, the coefficient is rather small, like 1% level. So you would end up needing a rather large set of statistics to actually extract this effect. But nonetheless, the general principle is still there. So you can use this method to gain some information about the spin. And also, if you have longer decay chains, and if you have measured the masses already, then even if you have missing particles, in many cases, you can fully reconstruct events. So there's another way of extending this kind of analysis. And we haven't quite done the similar analysis in the case of LHC yet, but at least by looking at the parameter counting, if you have, for example, the gluino pair production, and once you have measured the mass of the gluino and quarks using, for example, method the people in Davis have been developing, then you again have same number of observables as number of parameters. You can solve the equations fully, but again, up to two-fold ambiguity. We have not fully understood if the similar method would work in this case yet. So this is something still in the work. And another interesting thing about the LHC, unlike the E plus E minus, is that two beams are identical. So that brings up this issue that if you interchange two beams, the physics, of course, doesn't change, but that would turn cos phi, cos 3 phi, all these odd modes, to their negatives. So you actually lose all of those odd modes. So again, we are trying to see if, for example, by requiring some selection in the forward hemisphere versus backward hemisphere, you can still retain some of these odd modes. And you can in principle, and we know that, but still the effects turned out to be relatively small. So we are still looking at various examples to see what is the best way to demonstrate how well you can retain these odd modes in the case of two identical beams. But if you ask a question like this, suppose you have seen a peak, a resonance in lepton pairs, you would like to know if it's a scalar boson, a vector boson, or even Kaluza-Klein graviton. And if the Kaluza-Klein graviton is the answer, you might actually see this dramatic cos 4 phi dependence. So that's actually the next thing we are trying to look at. Okay, conclusions. Quantum interference among helicities does exist, and quantum mechanics, of course, is true. So this is what should happen, quite independent from the complicated models of any sort. This way of extracting information spin is completely model independent, and just this method should be demonstrable in the existing LEP2 and Tevatron data. So we haven't managed to convince anybody from LEP2 to actually do this kind of analysis yet because all of them are now working on LHC. But hopefully somebody would look at it and demonstrate that this is doable. And this effect is particularly useful near threshold when other spin correlations are not very prominent and works really well if the events are fully reconstructable. even if the events are only partially reconstructable, this could be used by using some of these clever techniques I mentioned earlier, but more studies are needed. And at the end of the day, once you go through all these kinds of measurements, we hope to decipher what new physics we might have discovered at the OHC. Thank you.
Was there any assumption that all the decaying particles decayed into two-body final states, or does this work equally well?
It doesn't have to be that way. So as long as you can define the definite plane in the decay products, it doesn't have to be two-body.
Three-body, of course, has to decay in a plane as well. So you're saying...
No, the three-body final state would open up.
If I have three particles coming out, they have to be in the same
place. Are you talking about production or decay?
No, decay.
Decay. Then if you have one particle moving this way and decay into three particles, that would open up.
Oh, in the rest frame.
In the lab frame.
In the rest frame, it's a plane.
That's right. But in the lab frame, it opens up.
In the lab frame, not.
But once you have identified final state particles, for example, you can decide to pick one of the particles and define the angle relative to the production plane using that particular particle. So there's always a way of defining this relative angle phi, even if you have multi-body final state.
Okay. So, but you haven't tested it?
Not yet.
So like for top quark, for instance?
Not yet.
Okay.
The Pivotron sample is too small. That I know already, yeah.
Okay, so we have some questions that we threw there.
Yeah, this reminds me of a similar situation. Presumably, you could also look for CP violation between the amplitudes by going from particle to antiparticle. We had exactly the same situation in KL40K, where you have sine 2 phi dependence, which identifies phases associated to right-handed currents. That's a paper we did with Gordy.
That's right. So there's one... you're right about this. There's one assumption we have made that there's no CP violation in this. And if there was CP violation, you might find sine phi, sine 2 phi dependencies, right? Nonetheless, if you do the Fourier analysis of phi dependence, you still have the same situation that you can extract information on the Hilbert differences, but the phase is shifted. Yes, you have more information that way. You're absolutely right.
For the Gluino case you mentioned for LHE, do you have a sense yet of the sort of minimum integrated luminosity it would take to do this? You must have started looking a little bit.
Well, I don't. The reason is that the Monte Carlo problems we have looked at so far don't retain this quantum interference information. They produce gluinos and let them decay independently without letting different helicities interfere. So we have started to write our own Monte Carlo to retain that information, and we haven't gotten there yet. That's where we are. If you actually know of any Monte Carlo problems which actually do have that quantum interference information in it, please, please let me know. But we haven't found one.
So I have a comment on your slide referring to the literature. There is quite some extended literature on the top spin correlations in TD bar production, where people have worked out the top spin density matrix, even including higher order radiative corrections to show how the radiative corrections changed the ratio of the various coefficients of the amplitudes that you extract. Plus, there are ATLAS studies, including detector simulation effects for that particular quantity. So people are working on this as well.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, Tochi, I had a similar comment. This is a completely standard technique that's used for more than 20 years in K and B physics. So, for instance, when people extracted semileptonic form factors in semileptonic B decays, what you do is to get the elicited amplitudes of the W using precisely the cos 2 phi dependence. And at the B factories, you even need this for some CP studies. For instance, sometimes the different elicited amplitudes have different CP parities. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, there's 100 papers on this, both theoretical and experimental.
Clearly not even 20 to 40 years. So we're not claiming credit on this observation that...
No, but it's used as we speak in many ongoing analyses.
This had not been used for the study of new particles at the energy frontier colliders.
That's because we haven't seen new particles, but it's been used to study the spin of the W for what you did with the lab data, this is done for, you can study the spin of the W using that.
Yes, and that's what people talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, but people have been doing this.
But there's no analysis on it from lab 2.
There's analysis from Clio, Argus, Babar,
Bell. But not on W pair, right?
Hmm?
But not on W pairs.
No, but W spin measurements, if you wish. By using the fact that there's a cos 2 phi dependence in the angular distributions.
Yes, and that's what I talked about. And no analysis has been done on that on lab 2 data.
Not on the lab 2 data, but on many other data sets.
Yeah, so I completely agree with you. Matt?
Can you say something, or do you know much yet about the sensitivity of your method to initial state radiation?
Initial state radiation is okay as long as it's strictly along the beam direction. So to the extent that is a small angle, it doesn't affect any of this.
Right, but at the LHC, there are substantial effects there. Do you have any sense quantitatively for how much that might?
You have the radiation with significant PT, as long as you actually capture the events in a way that still is rotation invariant under the relative rotation of the decay plane versus the production plane, that again is okay. That's the power of the simple quantum mechanical principle. That's the only thing you need.
Natasha?
Success?
Okay. So I guess you might have said this, but I got confused. In a real collider, we'll have, say, a muon coming from many, many, many processes, right? Cascade decays and the whole ball of wax. Doesn't this confuse the issue?
Oh, yeah, it does. So you need to have a clean sample.
But how do you hope to get it at the LHC?
Well, depends on the process you looked at. The examples I talked about, like Z plus Z, that's very clean.
No, that's of course very clean.
And that should be probably true also for the color
graviton.
Yeah, but
I mean, say, look at inclusive.
Yeah, in the case of the supersymmetry, of course, that gets much more complicated. So that's why I have not claimed anything that you can do exactly this in the case of supersymmetry at the LHC.
Okay.
I think that a generator like Matt Graff, if you ask for the full final state rather than doing a cascade chain,
that's right,
will generate a fully correct matrix element. So it will just take a little bit longer, but you can do it with Matt Graff.
Right. It's just that it takes longer.
Yeah, but it's not prohibitive for something like what you're doing.
Rohini?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. That's, for example, what we have done on the W pair sample. Yes.
Okay. I wanted to go back to also to the statement that Jean-Marie had made, that if you looked at, for example, there are suggestions that you look at Higgs to ZZ and let both the Zs go into L plus L minus, and then you look at the angle between the planes of the two decay electrons, which is essentially corresponding to your delta phi again.
But in that case, what are you looking at?
Depending on whether you have CP even or CP odd,
that's right, right.
You will get coefficients which are the coefficients of cos phi and cos 2 phi will be.
Yes, but that's the information on the Z boson spin, right? It's not.
Not the Higgs. But I'm just saying that this, in the CP violation context, this feature is, people have been suggesting can be used at the LHC.
Any more questions, folks? No? Okay, very good, thank you. So if there's technical people within my voice,